Chapter 9. Dinner began at 5 and went on until 7:40. It was a meal worthy of the age, the house, and the season. Pea soup to begin, followed by a roast swan with sweet sauce, giblets, mutton steaks, a partridge pie and 4 snipe. The second course was a plum pudding with brandy sauce, tarts, mince pies, custards and cakes, all washed down with the port wine and claret and Madeira and home-brewed ale. Ross felt that there was only one thing missing. Charles. The great paunch, the more or less subdued belches, the heavy good humour. At this moment the corporeal remains of that massive, mediocre, but not unkindly soul were rotting away and becoming one with the soil that had given it life and sustenance. The organic humours of which it was composed would soon be helping to feed the rank couch grass which overran the churchyard. But in this house, from which he had spent few nights away in the course of his 68 years, in this house remained some unspent aura of his presence, more noticeable to Ross than the aura of all the portraits of 46 ancestors. One did not so much feel sorrow at his absence as a sense of the unfitness of his not being here. For such a small party, the dining hall was too gaunt and draughty. They used the winter parlour, which faced west and was panelled to the ceiling and was convenient for the kitchens. Chance stage-managed Demelza's arrival. Verity had come to the large parlour to tell them that dinner was ready. Elizabeth was there, and the four of them left the room smiling and chattering together. As they did so, Demelza came down the stairs. She was wearing the dress that had been made up from Verity's choice, the very pale mauve silk with the half-length sleeves, slightly hooped and pulled apart like a letter A at the front, to show the flowered apple-green bodice and underskirt. What Ross could not quite understand was her appearance, her manner. Natural that he should be pleased with her. She had never looked so charming before. In her own queer way, this evening she rivaled Elizabeth, who started any such competition with advantages of feature and colouring over almost all women. Some challenge born in the situation had brought out the best of Demelza's good looks, her fine dark eyes, her hair neatly dressed and tied, her very pale olive skin with the warm glow under it. Verity was openly proud of her. At dinner, she didn't burst her stays. In Ross's opinion, she overdid her good behaviour by pecking at many things and always leaving the larger portion on her plate. She outvied Elizabeth, who was always so small an eater. A suspicious person might have thought her to be mocking her hostess. Ross was amused. Tonight she was on her mettle. A talkative girl at meals, full of questions and speculations. She took little part in the conversation at this meal, refused the burnt claret which the others drank, and herself drank only the home-brewed ale. But she didn't look bored, and her manner was always one of intelligent interest, while Elizabeth spoke of people she did not know, or gave some anecdote of Geoffrey Charles. When she was drawn in, she answered pleasantly, and naturally, and without affectation. Aunt Agatha's occasional broadsides didn't seem to disconcert her. She would look at Ross, who sat next to the old lady, and he would shout an answer. This put the onus on him of finding the right one. Talk turned on whether there was truth in the rumour of another attempt on the king's life. The last such rumour had certainly been true, when Margaret Nicholson tried to stab him at a levee. Francis made some cynical comments on the good cloth used in the royal waistcoat. Elizabeth said that she had been told the king's household servants had not been paid for 12 months. They talked of France and the magnificence of the court there. Francis said he was surprised someone had not tried to sharpen a knife on Louis, who was far more deserving of one than Farmer George. The French queen was trying to find a cure for all her ills in animal magnetism, Verity said she thought she would try that for her catarrh, for she had been told to drink half a pint of seawater daily, and she found she could not stomach it. Dr. Choke blamed all colds on the malignancy of the air. Raw meat put on a pole turned bad in 40 minutes, while similar meat kept in salt water remained fresh for a long time. Ross remarked that Choke was an old woman. Francis said perhaps there was literal truth in that statement, since Polly was so unfruitful. Elizabeth turned the conversation to her mother's eye trouble. Francis drank 10 glasses of port over the meal, but showed little change. A difference, Ross thought, from the old days, when he was always the first under the table.
"Boy's no head for liquor," Charles would grumble.
Ross glanced at Elizabeth, but her look was serene. At 8:15, the ladies rose and left the two men to drink brandy and smoke their pipes at the littered and derelict table. Between themselves, they talked business, but the conversation had not been in progress many minutes when Mrs. Tabb appeared at the door.
"If you please, sir, visitors has just come."
"What?"
"Mr. George Warleggan and Mr. and Mrs. John Treneglis, sir."
Ross felt a spasm of annoyance at having this surprise sprung on him. He had no wish to meet the all-successful George tonight. And he felt sure Ruth would not have come had she known he and Demelza were here. But Francis's surprise was genuine.
"Cock's life! So they come visiting on Christmas Eve, eh? What have you done with them, Emily?"
"They're in the big parlour, sir. Mistress Elizabeth said would you come soon and help entertain them, and they do not intend to stop long."
"Surely. We will go right away."
Francis waved his glass.
"Right away."
When Mrs. Tabb left, he lit his pipe.
"Imagine old George coming tonight. I thought he was spending Christmas at Cardew. A coincidence, what? And John and Ruth? You remember when we used to fight John and Richard, Ross?"
Ross did.
"George Warleggan," said Francis. "Great man. He'll own half of Cornwall before he's done. He and his cousin own more than half of me already."
He laughed.
"The other half he wants but can't have. Some things just won't go on the table."
"His cousin?"
"Carey Warleggan, the banker."
"A pretty name. I've heard him called a moneylender."
"Tut, would you insult the family?"
"The family grows too intrusive for my taste. I prefer a community run on simpler lines."
"They're the people of the future, Ross. Not the worn-out families like the Chenoweths and the Poldarks."
"It's not their vigour I query, but their use of it. If a man has vitality, let him increase his own soul, not set about owning other people's."
"That may be true of Cousin Carey, but it's a small matter hard on George."
"Finish your drink and we'll go," Ross said, thinking of Demelza with these new people to face.
"It is more than a little strange," said Francis. "Philosophers would no doubt hang some doxy name on it, but it seems to me just a plain perversity of life."
"What does?"
"Oh,"
the other hesitated.
"I don't know. We envy some other person for something he has got and we have not. Although, in truth, it may be that he really hasn't it. Do I make myself clear?"
"No, I thought not. Let's go and see George." They rose from the ruins of the feast and walked through into the hall. As they crossed it, they heard shouts of laughter from the large parlour.
"Making a carnival of my house," said Francis. "Can this be George the Elegant?"
"Long odds," said Ross, "on its being John the Master of Hounds." They entered and found his guess a good one. John Treneglis was sitting at Elizabeth's hand-spinning wheel. He was trying to work it. It seemed a simple enough action, but in fact needed practice, which John Treneglis lacked. He would get the wheel going nicely for some moments, but then his foot pressure on the treadle would not be quite even, and the cranked arm would suddenly reverse itself and stop. While it was working right, there was silence in the room, broken only by an interplay between Treneglus and Warlegan. But every time John went off his stroke, there was a roar of laughter. Treneglus was a powerful, clumsy man of 30, with sandy hair, deep-set eyes, and freckled features. He was known as a fine horseman, a first-class shot, the best amateur wrestler in two counties, a dunce at any game needing mental effort, and something of a bully. This evening, though on a social call, he wore an old brown velvet riding coat and strong corduroy breeches. It was his boast that he never wore anything but riding breeches, even in bed. Ross was surprised to see that de Melza was not in the room.
"You lose," said George Warlegan. "You lose. 5 guineas are mine. Ho, Francis!" "One more try, damn! The first was a trial try. I'll not be beat by a comical contraption of this sort."
"Where is de Melza?" said Ross to Verity, who was standing by the door.
"Upstairs. She wished to be left alone for a few moments, so I came down."
"You'll break it, John," said Elizabeth, smiling. "You're too heavy-footed."
"John," said his wife, "get up at once."
But John had been merrying himself with good brandy and took no notice. Once more he got the wheel going, and it seemed that this time he had done the trick. But at the wrong moment he tried to increase the speed, and the cranked arm reversed and everything came to a jerking standstill. George uttered a cry of triumph, and John Treneglus rose in disgust.
3 more times and I should have mastered the pesty thing."
"You must give me a lesson, Elizabeth. Here, man, take your money. It's ill-gotten and will stick in your crop."
"John is so excitable," said his wife. "I fear for your wheel. I think we are all a little foxed and the Christmas spirit has done the rest."
If John Treneglus set no store by fashion, the same could not be said of the new Mrs. Treneglus. Ruth Teague, the drab little girl of the Easter charity ball, had shot ahead. An instinct in Ross had sensed at the ball that there was more in her than met the eye. She wore a blossom-coloured hoopless dress of Spitalfields silk, with silver spangles at the waist and shoulders. An unsuitable dress for travelling the countryside, but no doubt her wardrobe was well stocked. John would have other calls on his pocket now besides his hunters, and John would not have things all his own way.
"Well, well, Captain Poldark," said Treneglus ironically. "We're neighbours, but this is how we meet. For all we see of you, you might be Robinson Crusoe."
"Oh, but he has his man Friday, dear," said Ruth gently.
"Who? Oh, you mean Judd,"
said Treneglus, blunting the edge of his wife's remark.
"A hairless ape, that. He cheeked me once. Had he not been your servant, I'd have given him a beating. And what of the mine? Old father is cock-a-hoop and speaks of shovelling in the copper."
"Nothing ambitious," Ross said, "but gratifying so far as it goes."
"Egad," said George, "must we talk business? Elizabeth, bring out your harp. Let us have a song."
"I have no voice," said Elizabeth, with her lovely slow smile. "If you have a mind to accompany me..."
"We'll all accompany you."
George was deferential.
"It would suit the knight admirable."
Not for George the self-confident uncouthness of John Treneglus, who traced his ancestry back to Robert, Count of Mortain. It was hardly credible that a single generation divided a tough, gnarled old man who sat in a cottage in his shirt sleeves and chewed tobacco and could barely write his name from this cultured young man in the new-fashioned, tight-cut pink coat with buff lapels. Only something of the blacksmith's grandson showed in the size of his features, in the full, tight, possessive lips, in the short neck above the heavy shoulders.
"Is de Melza coming down?"
Ross asked Verity quietly.
"She has not been overawed by these people." "No, I don't think she knows they're here,"
Let's have a hand of Pharaoh, said Francis. I was damned unlucky on Saturday. Fortune cannot always be sulky.
But he was shouted down. Elizabeth must play the harp. They had come specially to hear Elizabeth play. Already George was moving the instrument out of its corner, and John was bringing forward the chair she used. Elizabeth, protesting and smiling, was being persuaded. At that moment, Demelza came in. Demelza was feeling better. She had just lost the dinner she had eaten and the ale she had drunk. The occurrence itself had not been pleasant, but, like the old Roman senators, she was feeling the better for it. The demon nausea had gone with the food and all was well. There was a moment's silence after she entered. It was noticeable then that the guests had been making most of the noise. Then Elizabeth said,
"This is our new cousin, Demelza, Ross's wife."
Demelza was surprised at this influx of people whom she must now meet. She remembered Ruth Teague from seeing her once on a visit to Ross, and she had seen her husband twice out hunting. Squire Treneglos's eldest son, one of the big men of the neighbourhood. When she last saw them both, she had been a long-legged, untidy kitchen wench, for whom neither of them would have spared a second glance. Or Ruth would not. By them, and by George Warleggan, who from his dress she felt must be at least the son of a lord. She was overawed. But she was learning fast that people, even well-bred people like these, had a surprising tendency to take you at your own valuation.
"Damn it, Ross," Treneglos said. "Where have you been hiding this little blossom? It was ungrateful of you to be so close about it. Your servant, ma'am."
Since to reply "your servant, sir," was clearly wrong, besides being too near the truth, Demelza contented herself with a pleasant smile. She allowed herself to be introduced to the other two, then accepted a glass of port from Verity and gulped half of it down while they were looking the other way.
"So this is your wife, Ross," said Ruth sweetly. "Come and sit by me, my dear. Tell me all about yourself. All the county was talking of you in June."
"Yes," said Demelza.
"People dearly love a gossip, don't they, ma'am?"
John roared and slapped his thigh.
"Quite right, mistress. Let's drink a toast. A merry Christmas to us all round, and damnation to the gossips."
"You're drunk, John," said Ruth severely. "You will not be able to sit your horse if we don't leave at once."
"First we must hear Elizabeth play," said George,
who had been exchanging some close confidence with Elizabeth.
"Do you sing, Mistress Poldark?" asked John.
"Me?" said Demelza in surprise. "No, only when I'm happy."
"Are we not happy now?" asked John. "Christmastide? You must sing for us, ma'am." "Does she sing, Ross?"
Francis inquired. Ross looked at Demelza, who shook her head vigorously.
"No," said Ross.
This denial seemed to carry no weight. Somebody must sing to them, and it looked as if it was going to be Demelza. The girl emptied her wine glass hurriedly, and someone refilled it.
"I only sing by myself," she said. "I mean, I don't rightly know proper tunes. Elizabeth must play first. Later, maybe?"
Elizabeth was very gently running her fingers up and down the harp. The faint rippling sound was a liquid accompaniment to the chatter.
"If you sing me a few bars," she said, "I think I could pick it up."
No, said Demelza, backing away. "You first. You play first."
So presently Elizabeth played, and at once the company fell silent. Even the tipsy John and the well-soaked Francis. They were all Cornish, and music meant something to them. She played first a piece by Handel, and then a short sonatina by Krumpholz. The plucked, vibrating tones filled the room, and the only other sound was the murmur of burning wood from the fire. The candle glow fell on Elizabeth's young head,
and on her slim hands moving over the strings. The light made a halo of her hair. Behind her stood George Warleggan, stocky and polite and ruthless, his hands behind his back, his eyes fixed unwinkingly on the player. Verity had subsided on a stool, a tray of glasses on the floor beside her. Against a background of blue moreen curtains, she sat with hands clasped about her knees, her head up, and showing the line of her throat above its lace fichu. Her face, in its repose, reminded one of the younger Verity, of 4 years ago. Next to her, Francis lolled in a chair, his eyes half closed, but listening. And beside him, Aunt Agatha chewed meditatively, a dribble of saliva at the corner of her mouth, listening too, but hearing nothing. In her finery, sharply different from the old lady, but having something strangely in common with her in the vitality of her manner, was Ruth Treneglas. One felt that she might be no beauty, but that she too would take some killing off when the time came. Next to her was Demelza, who had just finished her third glass of port and was feeling better every minute. And beyond her, Ross stood, a little withdrawn, glancing now and then from one to another of the company with his unquiet eyes. John Treneglas was half listening to the music, half goggling at Demelza, who seemed to have a peculiar fascination for him. The music came to a stop, and Elizabeth leaned back, smiling at Ross. Applause was on the quieter note than could have been expected 10 minutes ago. The harp music had touched at something more fundamental than their high spirits. It had spoken not of Christmas jollity and fun, but of love and sorrow, of human life, its strange beginning and its inevitable end.
"Superb," declared George. "We were more than repaid for a ride 20 times as long. Elizabeth, you pluck at my heartstrings."
"Elizabeth," said Verity, "play me that canzonetta. As an encore, please. I love it."
"It is not good unless it's sung."
"Yes, yes, it is. Play it as you played it last Sunday night."
Silence fell again. Elizabeth played something very short by Mozart, and then a canzonetta by Haydn. There was silence when this was over, before anyone spoke.
"It is my favourite," said Verity. "I cannot hear it often enough."
"They're all my favourites," said George, "and played like an angel. One more, I beg you."
"No," said Elizabeth, smiling. "It's Demelza's turn. She will sing for us now." "After that, I could not," said Demelza, whom the last piece and the strong wine had much affected. "I was praying to God you had forgotten me."
Everyone laughed.
"We must hear this and go," said Ruth, with an eye on her husband. "Please, Mistress Poldark, overcome your modesty and satisfy us as to your attainments. We are all agog."
Demelza's eyes met those of the other girl and saw in them a challenge. She rose to it. The port had given her Dutch courage.
"Well?"
With mixed feelings, Ross saw her walk across to the harp and sit down at the seat Elizabeth had left. She could not play a note on the instrument, but the instinct was sound which persuaded her to take up this position. The others were grouped round it to listen, and she was saved the awkwardness of standing with nothing to do with her hands. But 10 minutes ago was the time when she should have sung, when everyone was jolly and prepared to join in. Elizabeth's cultured, delicate playing had changed the atmosphere. The anticlimax would be certain. Demelza settled herself comfortably, straightening her back, and plucked at a string with her finger. The note it gave out was pleasing and reassuring. Contrast with Elizabeth. Gone was the halo, and in its place the dark crown of humanity. She looked at Ross. In her eyes was a demon of mischief. She began to sing. Her slightly husky voice, almost contralto,
an imperceptible fraction off the note, and sweet-toned, made no effort to impress by volume. Rather, it seemed to confide as a personal message what it had to say.
I'd a pluck a fair rose for my love. I'd a pluck a red rose blowin'. Love's in my heart to try and so to prove what your heart's a knowin'. I'd a pluck a finger on a thorn. I'd a pluck a finger bleedin'. Red is my heart, a wounded and forlorn, and your heart a needin'. I'd a hold a finger to my tongue, I'd a hold a finger waiting. My heart is sore until it joins in song with your heart mating.
There was a moment's pause, and Demelza coughed to show that she had done. There came murmurs of praise, some of it merely polite, but some of it spontaneous.
Very charming, said Francis, through half-closed lids. Egad, said John Treneglis with a sigh. I like that.
Egad, said Demelza, sparkling at him. I was afeard you might not.
A sharp answer, ma'am, said Treneglis.
He was just beginning to realise why Ross had committed the solecism of marrying his kitchen maid.
Have you any more of the same?
Songs or answers, sir? Asked Demelza. I have not heard that piece before, said Elizabeth. I am much taken with it.
Songs, I meant, chit, said Treneglis, putting his feet up. I know you have the answers.
John, said his wife, it is time we were going.
I am comfortable here. Thank you, Verity. A good body this port has, Francis. When did you get it? Trencrom's firm. Their stuff has been less good of late. I must make a change. I bought some passable port the other day, said George. Regrettably, tax had been paid, and it ran me in for near on 3 guineas for 13-quart bottles.
Francis raised an ironical eyebrow. George was a good friend and an indulgent creditor, but he could not refrain from bringing into a conversation the price he had paid for things. It was almost the only sign left of his origins.
How do you contrive for servants now, Elizabeth?
Ruth asked, her voice carrying.
I have the utmost difficulty. Mama was saying this morning that there was really no satisfying 'em. The young generation, she was saying, have such ideas, always wishing to rise above their station. One more song, Demelza, please,
Verity interposed.
What was that you were wont to play when I stayed with you? You remember? The Sainer's song.
I like them all, said John. Damn, I had no idea we was in such gifted company.
Demelza drained her newly filled glass. Her fingers went over the strings of the harp and made a surprising sound.
I have another,
she said gently. She looked at Ross a moment, then at Treneglis from under her lashes. The wine she had drunk had lit up her eyes. She began to sing, very low, but very clear.
I suspicion she was pretty. I suspicion she was wed. My father told me 'twas against the law. I saw that she was coxy, no loving here by proxy, as pretty a piece of mischief as never I saw. With no intentions meaning, I called at candle-teening. All's fair, they say, in love as well as war. My good intentions dropped me, no father's warning stopped me, as pretty a piece of mischief as never I saw.
Here she paused, then opened her eyes for a second at John Treneglis, before she sang the last verse.
The nest was warm around us. No spouse came home and found us. Our youth, it was as sweet as it was raw. And now the cuckoo's homing, attired of his roaming, as pretty a piece of mischief as never I saw.
John Treneglas roared and slapped his thighs. Demelza helped herself to another glass of port.
Bravo, said George. I like that song. It has a pleasant tripping sound. Well sung indeed.
Ruth rose.
Come, John. It will be tomorrow before we reach home.
Nonsense, my dear.
John tugged at the fob attached to his chronometer, but the watch would not come out of his deep pocket.
Has anyone the time? It cannot be 10 yet.
You did not like my song, ma'am?
Demelza asked, addressing Ruth. Ruth's lips moved a fraction.
Yes, indeed. I found it most enlightening.
It is the 9:30, said Wardleggan.
Indeed, ma'am, said Demelza. I am surprised you'd need enlightening on such a matter.
Ruth went white at the nostrils. It is to be doubted whether Demelza understood the full flavour of her remark. But with 5 large glasses of port inside her, she was not given to weighing the pros and cons of a retort before she made it. She felt Ross come up behind her, his hand touch her arm.
It was not of the matter I was speaking.
Ruth's gaze went past her.
May I congratulate you, Ross, on a wife so very skilled in all the arts of entertainment?
Not skilled, said Ross, squeezing Demelza's arm, but a very quick learner.
The choice of tutor means so much, does it not?
Oh, yes, agreed Demelza.
Ross is so kind he could charm the sourest of us into a show of manners.
Ruth patted her arm. She had the opening she wanted.
I don't think you are quite the best judge of that yet, my dear.
Demelza looked at her and nodded.
No, maybe I should have said all but the sourest.
Before the exchange became still more deadly, Verity interposed. The visitors were moving off. Even John was at last levered from his chair. They all drifted out into the hall. Amid much laughter and last-minute talk, cloaks were put on, and Ruth changed her delicate slippers for buckle riding shoes. Her new-fashioned riding cloak had to be admired. A full half-hour passed while affectionate goodbyes and seasonal wishes were given and received, jokes made and replied to. At last, to the clop and clatter of hooves, the party moved off down the drive, and the big door banged. The Poldarks were alone again.